Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Firstly, Sol, it's been a long time I've wanted to speak to you, and I've been aware of you and examined for a long time and used the service regularly through many different jobs that I've had. Before we get too into the long grasp talking about you and the company, I was hoping you could just give an overview for people who might not be aware of examine.com, what it is you guys do.
So we analyze health research, nutrition research, primarily around supplementation, but we're working on effectively analyzing anything that impacts your health. So generally, when we think about impacting health, we think about like food and, you know, supplements and exercise and prescription medication. That's all true. But what about music? What about light therapy? Even more esoteric stuff like menstrual cups, right? They all impact your health. But where can you go to get information that you can trust? So that's kind of what we're trying to build out, is you can look up ideally any kind of intervention that will impact your health, and then any facet of your health that you're interested in. You might want to swim faster. You might want to run longer. You might want to have your bones not hurt. So the ability for anyone to look up the evidence around it as summarized by us, that is what we are trying to build over at examine.com.
I first became aware of you right when you launched, and I want to get into the details of how you launched. I think that's a fascinating little subset of what I want to talk about in its own right. But can you talk a little bit about where the idea came from? Because it's one of those ideas that once it's there, it seems so obvious that it's always been needed. But obviously, it wasn't until you came along. Tell us a little bit about where that idea came from and how long it took to kind of get it off the launch pad.
For sure. So what I will say before I get into it is the idea wasn't the hard part. It was the monetization that was actually really difficult. And we can get into that. So the original genesis is I used to be a lot heavier, significantly heavier. And when I moved back to Toronto 14 years ago, wow, time flies. As I started losing weight, one of the things I got sucked into was supplementation. Right. So I bought every imaginable supplements, green tea and everything legal anyway. Right. I tried it all. Obviously, you know, it didn't really work. And months or like years later, I was hanging out with some friends in Colombia. They're both postdocs. And I was complaining about like, hey, you know what? For example, they sell the glutamine is going to make your muscles 300% larger. Now, I don't have the world's giantest bicep, but 300% is like, come on, man. Even Ronnie Coleman is like, yikes, that's just way too much, right? And the reality, of course, was it was 300% inside a petri dish. But when you put inside the human body, in vivo, it becomes a different kind of monster. So I was complaining about this to my friends, and they're like, dude, you're not really doing much with life and in your life right now anyway. Why don't you do something about it? Like, shut the hell up and stop complaining and do something. I was like, ugh. So that was actually 100% legitimately the genesis. I remember emailing some friends to get it started. I remember emailing some other friends who had domain names, which is why, you know, we were able to acquire examine.com. So that was the original genesis. Now, when we first started, truly, we were only looking into kind of like bodybuilding supplements, right? Like, oh, yeah, creatine, and does fish oil actually help you get stronger? But as we kind of put the website out, people started contacting us. They're like, hey, what about vitamin C? What about multivitamins? And hey, how do I stay on top of the latest research? All that kind of stuff. So the key part was less, hey, I have this idea and let's build it. I think what was far more important was by listening to our users, telling us what they were really looking for, right? What were their problems that we were trying to solve? That's what we were able to do and kind of grow over the years. The example I always use is minivans. Nobody wants a minivan, right? It is the least cool, by far the least sexy car in the world. And yet, hundreds of thousands of minivans are sold every year. And subsequently, what's happened is we know minivans are for families, right? Minivans have been at the forefront of technology or innovation for families. They were one of the first to have screens at the back of their headrest, right? So your kids would shut the hell up. They were one of the first ones to have the touchless entry in your trunk, right? So it opens, so because you have too much stuff and your kids are running around. So a lot of it is just like, how do we respond to what the users are looking for and give them what they want? And then everything else kind of generally falls in place after that.
So when you, obviously you come up with the idea, it's, as you said, by your own admission, not the world's like most complicated original idea. The monetization then, because with so many startups now, it's all about spend,
yeah,
build that user base, get the data. We'll worry about monetizing it down the road, right?
Yeah.
When it was launched in, 2011, right?
Yeah, 2011, yeah.
It was a slightly different environment there, right? I imagine the return on your investment needed to come a little bit quicker. What did you do around launch and once you'd launched to make sure that you were going to get paid?
So we actually kind of zigged while everyone zagged, right? So I first started working online back in 99. I've always resisted any kind of external money. I've always been more interested in kind of building my own little thing, kind of doing my own rules. As an example, for over a year, we've been 4-day work week at Xamarin. It might not be the world's most productive thing, even though I actually don't think it makes a huge difference. But I did it because that's what I want to do. I don't want to work on Fridays, so I don't work on Fridays. And it's unfair for me to not work on Fridays and nobody else and everybody else does. So we just made a company-wide. So our actual approach originally was, we won't know how we'll make money. And so it was a very small project. We weren't trying to build out a huge team. We weren't like, hey, we're going to throw all this money at it. It was more like, I will spend all my energies on the non-research side because that's what I know, right? I've done it so many times. I coded, I can get a website up. And then my co-founder can just be like, hey, let's just focus on the research side. You don't have to do it all the time. You can do something else. Now, he was super excited for it. So I was like, hey, you know what? I have money. And this is where kind of like the advantage comes. I realize this, right? I had previous financial success from other stuff I'd done online. So I was like, hey, I'll pay you the most basic salary just so you have enough to, let's say, survive. But we don't have to chase generating revenue right now. The difference, of course, is the funded companies are burning through millions of dollars a year, right? So they have to generate real revenue. Whereas if I'm burning $40,000 a year, which isn't a small amount, but in the grand scheme of things, like, all right, I can absorb it for a year or two. So that's kind of how we got started. Now, our big thing was always, the problem with information online is, how can you trust who's giving you the information, right? If I go to New York Times, and New York Times tells me, hey, the best lawn chair is this. By the way, if you click on it, it goes to Amazon, we make money from it. You're like, even if it is, you're not lying. I'm a little bit highly suspicious in the back around it, right? So our entire thing was like, hey, we're going to put this information out there. It's just useful for ourselves originally. We had no idea. To be honest, I had no idea that we'd become as big as we'd become or as big as we'd like to become. It was more just like, let's do this. And then eventually, if we want, you know, the typical like coaching or services or consulting, thankfully we're able to eschew it all. But that was our original plan, was like, you know, we'll kind of figure it out. We'll build up that trust. We'll build up the reputation. So when we say, hey, we're going to sell you coaching as an example, no one is like, oh, I can't trust you. Everyone's like, okay, we understand, you know, we'll kind of work with you. So that's kind of how we were originally approaching it. But obviously, you know, it changed over time.
Trust and authenticity are something that every single brand wants. But you managed to, I guess, A, achieve it in the first place, or B, have it with sincerity that backs it up. It's a bit cynical. You know what they're trying to do. I've never sensed that with Xamarin. Could you explain, if you can put your finger on it, how you did create that genuine level of trust and authenticity?
Actually, I got to admit, it was both very difficult and very easy. It was very difficult because when we came in, no one knew who the hell we were, right? So we just came out of nowhere. How can you trust us? Now, what we did, and I spent a lot of effort, was reaching out to more established people, more respected people, and proving to them that, you know what, we're taking this seriously. There's a lot of people who have stories of when we first started, they're like, yeah, this weird guy randomly just contacted me, he's talking about supplements. I'm like, buzz off. And now, like, 12 years later, we're best friends. They're like, oh, yeah, 3 years later, I was like, finally, you know, we've done it. In fact, one of my favorites was, there was a guy who owned and ran a pain website. And for 2 years, he rebuffed us. He was like, ah, whatever. And then 2 years later, he actually wrote on his website about how he trusted us because, you know, I was tenacious and the information and all that kind of stuff. Separately to that, the easy part was, you know, trust is basically you're conveying what you're doing, or I'd like to think this, in a transparent and open way. And so one of the things is, you know, we have an editorial policy. We talk about how we do research. We have a very strict policy that nobody, including myself, on a personal level, gives any kind of testimonials. We don't do any joint ventures. We don't take money from anybody. So, for example, the date's a little bit off, but like 8 years ago, we wrote for CrossFit Journal about adrenal fatigue. And CrossFit Journal was like, hey, we're going to have to pay you. And we're like, yeah, no, thank you. We don't want any money. And there was this huge back and forth. They're like, no, we have to pay you. And so at the end of the day, they gave us a dollar, was the agreed amount. They gave us a dollar. And I posted a picture of the check online, and then I immediately tore the check and threw it away, right? So we told our users we're not taking any money. We gave them examples of not giving any money. So, you know, you can dig into whatever you want. You will never find anyone has ever given us money. And subsequently, you won't find a testimonial from me. You won't find a testimonial from Kamal, from anybody on the team vouching for any supplement, connected to any supplement. So when we're kind of like Switzerland in our own little bubble, we don't care what other people are doing. We don't even care if you don't like us. If you don't like us, that's fair. Like, you're allowed to have your opinions, as terrible as it may be. We're more focused on, we're just going to look at the research. We're going to try to give you the nuance. We're going to try to build something we would want to use. That's kind of the baseline of what we're trying to build over all these years.
And you can't fake that, right? If you're creating something that you would use, you're not going to take shortcuts. You're not going to do all the things you mentioned that perhaps other brands or other websites would do. I remember when I first became aware of Xamin, and as someone who's worked in fitness media for a long time, I follow a lot of big names. And it felt as though you went onto, it was Twitter at the time because Instagram wasn't around. Uh-huh. And everyone was talking about this brand new service, this brand new guide. And yeah, it felt as though you'd come from nowhere, but you'd got all these big hitters on board, and it had to be taken seriously. So I investigated it and I liked what I found. From the outside looking in, it feels like you've absolutely smashed that, right? You've got all the big names on board. They're all talking the same message. It's amazing publicity. But from your side of it, that might feel like banging a door down, getting rejected, getting knockbacks. Talk us through that process of kind of, you know, that buzz marketing approach, and how difficult or perhaps how easy it was.
It was totally not easy. It was, so the thing is, you know, people talk about relationships in a very transactional manner, right? They're like, hey, you know, I have this, you have this, let's make a relationship or let's become BFFs, but not really. I'm much more interested in the irreverent side. I'm much more interested in, hey, you know, are you a Chelsea fan, which is why you're wearing blue, right? Or do you hate them in Man City, whatever, right? Like, I'm far more interested in the human being. So I think the first important part was, beyond, you know, the information being accurate and whatever, is I was keenly interested in getting to know these humans. And so obviously the easiest way, for the record, anyone who wants to bring in any industry, is you just go to the events. Like, never mind online, don't bother with cold emails or any of that stuff. Just go to an event. There's a million, any industry has a million different events. Just go to them, right? Even fitness has hundreds every month in your local community, your city, all that kind of stuff. So it was a lot of work. It was a lot of, I would say work, actually, that might not be the right word. It was a lot of time. It was like, hey, let's talk about this, let's talk about that. Even today, I have all these connections, let's say, that I've built over decades now, right? Since I started in 99. And almost every single one of them is built on some kind of personal connection. Oh, you're an NBA fan. Oh, you like this. Oh, we talked about that. We can talk about parenting. We can talk about all these other things, moral philosophy, TV shows, all that kind of stuff. So that was really the connection. And then once you have the connection, right, once you get along with someone, like, imagine if a buddy of yours that you trust or get along with comes across and is like, hey, man, you should read this website. You're 20 times more likely to listen to them, right? You're like, all right, I know you're not a jerk. I know you're not trying to sell me something. Okay, let's look at it. So that was the other thing too. When over, like, we took 2.5 years to generate a single cent. And so in those 2.5 years, they knew we weren't trying to sell them something. We weren't trying to sell them any coaching. And then the final bit was, we stayed in our lane. Like, too many companies, in my opinion, try to do everything, right? We've never sold coaching. We've never sold services. So imagine if you're a registered dietitian, you get along with me, and then you find out Xamin is selling coaching, which is competing exactly with your livelihood. And as an RD, you have to go to university and get all this board certified, whereas we're just like, we're just going to coach you for nutrition. It causes a little bit of rift, right? It causes a little bit of like bandwagon, like circling the bandwagon. You're like, ugh, I don't want to deal with you. So because we always stayed in our lane, we're always very respectful about everyone else and what they're doing. We're not here to criticize you. We're not here to talk shit. I think that's why people were so eager. And then the final thing, and this sounds a little bit rude, but it's the truth. People love showing off that they're smart or they're awesome. So it was an opportunity for a lot of people to be like, hey, man, I know this smart website you might have not heard of. It's kind of cool. And so generally the feedback that people were getting from their fans, audience, friends, whatever, was, this is super cool, this is super cool, this is super cool. It was a lot of time, it was a lot of organization. I remember having spreadsheets and all that kind of stuff just to keep track of everything because it was so much. But the relationships were all based on commonalities and common interests and not, you know, you're X or you're Y, you're big, you're small, that kind of stuff.
And I guess all that hard work and that networking and the handshaking, it only works though if you've got a product at the back end that has that trust and has that authenticity, right? Because it doesn't matter how long you're going to spend shaking all of those hands, if you don't then have a product or a service that people want to be associated with, or maybe there's a few gray areas, ultimately it's all going to fall flat on its face, right?
I think that in the short term, you can get away with the garbage stuff. You can get away with, I mean, to be honest, you can kind of get away with the garbage stuff in many different ways. But I think the key here is, if you are making something good, people will continue to talk about it. I think that's the primary difference. So as an example, we get, tens of thousands of visitors from Google every day. And the reason why Google trusts us so much is there's so many links to us. And the reason why there's so many links to us is people trust us and they like linking to our information. They know that if they go, hey, go to Xamarin for creation information, again, we're not going to try to steal their clients or their patients or their customers, right? They know the information we're going to give them is useful. So over time, that strong reputation builds up and adds up. In the short term, maybe not. And even today, when I talk to anyone about our revenue or where we're going, I tell them, I'm like, I'm not interested in how much money we're going to make this year or next year, or even in 2 years or 3 years. I'm interested in how much do we do, or what can we do in 5 years? What can we do in 10 years? I have no desire to rush anything to immediately make my, let's say I generate an extra million and I sell the company for more. Like, great, what does that do for me, right? In the grand scheme of things, nothing. I'm much more interested in that, how do we build a juggernaut? And too many people, in my opinion, take that short interim point of view, whereas I'm much more like, you know, think about it. If Xamarin's turning 12 in less than 2 months, in 10 years, that's 22 years I've worked on this company. That's what I'm much more interested in, is what do we look like after 20 years instead of, you know, what do we look like tomorrow or in 3 months time? And once you have that viewpoint, I think it shifts your way of approaching and talking product, relationships, all that kind of stuff. It has to.
I remember reading a LinkedIn post you wrote, it was a number of years ago, probably 5 or 6 years now, about email segmentation. And you basically talked through the process of what you'd done. And the results were astonishing from that segmented approach of what people had done, how long they'd lingered on an email, what they'd interacted with. And it's something I hadn't really considered before. I saw myself as a consumer who was smarter than email marketing campaigns and when I was ready to do it. And it just opened my mind to the tools and the resources that were available there. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how you've used this email marketing technique to really maximize the impact of sales events, special offers, all the other things that you do to draw customers in.
For sure. I think at the most basic level of it, there's like a running kind of joke in people who are into communications that the most beautiful phrase you'll hear is your own name, right? If you're walking down the street and you even remotely hear someone say Joe Warner, you're like, hello, you know, like, are you talking about me? I'm amazing. You're correct. Like, yes, I can help you. So really, email segmentation is how do I make you feel special or unique, or that I see what you're looking for? The simplest example we have is when we're doing a sale, we're sending out emails, we specifically say, hey, if you don't want to hear about this sale again, unsubscribe. I don't think I've seen a lot of companies do that. And for me, if I'm an end user and I'm going to get 10 emails in this course of 5 days, we don't do that much. We don't do anything like that. But let's just say, right, aggressive company. If I have the optionality of clicking on a link once and never hearing for a sale because maybe I lost my job, you know, maybe I just don't have the money, maybe I just don't care, right? Maybe I'm already an existing customer. The company is basically saying, I understand you're a unique person. I'm giving you the optionality to remove yourself from this conversation. That's all email segmentation is how do I personalize to your behavior? So the easiest segmentation is basically user behavior. And the easiest user behavior in your email is, what are they clicking on, or are they even clicking? So if we send out, as a theoretical experiment, if we send out 3 sales emails and you don't even open up a single email, there's no reason for me to send you a 4th, right? I mean, maybe there's a marginal gain, but there's a higher likelihood that you'll unsubscribe or angrily go like, fuck these guys, right? You never want to hear from them again. On the other hand, if you have clicked on all 3 sales emails, it makes sense for me to possibly go, here's a stronger offer, or make it more aggressive, or not more aggressive, more like in your face, or more like, hey, it ends tomorrow, whatever. That's all it is. So email segmentation is just us trying to meet you as who you are. Now, the advanced stuff can be based on demographics, right? If you're a registered dietitian, we mentioned you can get CPEUs as an RD. If you're an NASM trainer, we can mention this. If you're an NSCA trainer, we can mention that. If you have chronic health conditions, we can mention that. All how to get that information is a whole different beast, right? Are you getting it from the user? Are you trying to do it based on who they are? Are you getting it from their email, right? We generally know AOL users are less sophisticated than Gmail. So should we send out a simpler email for AOL? I don't know. That's something you can define. The other thing that's now super interesting is Google Analytics 4, which a lot of people are moving from the previous version, Universal Analytics. Everything it does is based on user behavior. Like, it doesn't track page views anymore. It tracks user behavior. So that email segmentation now directly connects to your user's behavior on your website. And the easiest place where a segmentation like that is beautiful is when somebody purchases from you. So we're a subscription company, right? We have 10,000 plus subscribers. If you subscribe and you don't do a single action in 5 days, and we have a free trial for 7 days, it makes sense on the sixth day for us to go like, hey, can we help you with something? We will much more likely save a potential free trial customer. We could even say like, hey, we saw you haven't had the time in the past 6 days. If you click here, we'll extend your free trial for another week. That's segmentation. So really what it is can I take user behavior and figure out how to personalize or act towards their best interests? And if I can, you know, these are the like content and these are the steps I'll take for them. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's a perfect explanation. And obviously all of those tactics in terms of the affiliate marketing, the email segmentation really got you off. From my point of view, it felt like to a really strong start. But was there a moment where you woke up one morning or turned down your computer at the end of the day and thought, we've done it, we've made it? Or does that moment change as your goals change and your ambitions change?
That goal, I've never met anyone that's like, I've achieved it all, I'm now done, I'm becoming a hermit or a monk or something, and I'm done forever. I guess
in terms of the business being something that was going to grow, it wasn't just going to be a flash in the pan, there was something sustainable there that you felt the foundations were in place to do more with it.
For sure. So the first one actually was Dr. Oz. So this one, we're just very, very nascent, right? We're getting like 100 visitors a day kind of thing. So Dr. Oz mentioned raspberry ketones as some fat loss thing. This is, I think, 2012. And we were, I think, number 6 on Google for raspberry ketone dosage, not even the actual keyword. And we got like 1,000 visitors over the course of like 24 hours. And my mind was blown. I was like, whoa, we're actually... So my thing is like, so the background is I'm an immigrant. I came when I was 14. You know, all my relatives are back in Pakistan and India. The example I always give is my sister got married like 5-6 years ago. Half my relatives got denied visas because the Canadian government said, hey, we don't know if you're going to go back to your country. I don't even care about the good or bad or whatever. My point is I'm in a very privileged position relative to my family. So I'm always like, how can I do something interesting, right? And examine is a way to do something where we actually help people and ideally, you know, also have a business that sustains both. So that raspberry ketone dosage was the first moment where I was like, wow, we had 1,000 people read our information. And hopefully they were like, wow, raspberry ketones are a complete waste of time. Dr. Oz is a snuffleupagus. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I should not be buying raspberry ketone. That was the original moment. The second one was actually the launch we're talking about. When all these people kind of said like, hey, it was more the words they said, right? It wasn't, hey, buy this stuff and examine, blah, blah, blah. It was more like, I love this stuff. I use it myself. When you're like, wow, people, because that was also me going through my fitness journey, right? When you're like, wow, people I looked up to, people whose content I read to impact my health are speaking positively and very nicely about our work, you know, that's amazing, right? Imagine someone, like imagine anyone you really respect. They're like, yeah, man, Joe Warner is a great dude. You're like, wow, thank you. That's awesome. So that was definitely the moment where I was like, wow, we're possibly onto something. And subsequently, there's been actually a lot of moments where I'm like, my favorite one, the last one, is a former employee of ours. She spoke at some event. She came back to a Toronto airport and she's getting an Uber drive back home. And the Uber driver is pegging her with questions. Like, what were you doing? What were you doing? Like, oh, and you know, you're dead after an event, right? You're just like, leave me alone. I just want to pass out, like pretend I don't exist. So eventually it was like, hey, you know, what do you do? She's like, oh, I work for this nutrition company. Like, oh, what do they do? Like, we analyze health research. What's it called? Examine.com. The woman started crying, right? This Uber driver just started crying. My employee is like, did I do something? Did I offend you? So she pulls over on a highway. For anyone in Toronto, this is a Gardiner. It's a very small highway. There's not a lot of shoulder space. and she's bawling, and she records a 17-minute video to Kamal, my co-founder, and I, about how she had this health issue and how examen saved her life, and without examen, she doesn't know if she could drive anymore or do all this stuff. That is still my number one favorite moment, where you're like, wow, this random person has impacted. It's 17-minute videos. I have actually a policy where I'm like, don't send me videos, don't send me voice messages. I'm not going to listen to them. Even if they're 20 seconds long, I'm going to ignore them. I'm going to be like, no, thank you. 17 minutes was a lot for me to go through, but it was one of those like moments where you're like, this is amazing, right? Like in a kind of a selfish way, but also not. You're like, I wish other people could experience this, because this is not something that most people get to experience, but we've actually impacted someone positively. So that was my moment, made a moment, I guess.
Because I assume you think and you hope you're making a difference, but until you get that real world proof, you don't know that you have made a difference.
And you know, working online, you'll mostly hear from people who don't like what you're doing, right? 10.1 times, you'll hear from people who don't like your stuff. So it's always really gratifying when someone says something really nice, and you're like, hey, you had... As humans, we don't really go out of our way to compliment anybody. So for someone to compliment a website, a company, is incredibly rare, right? So it's always very gratifying to hear such nice words.
It would be remiss of me not, now having gone through some of your highlights, to talk about some of your mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
With examining, you know, is there anything you would go back and readily admit, we dropped the ball there, that was a mistake? And if so, how would you do things differently if you had another run at it?
Oh, massive mistakes. There's two mistakes I think that were fundamental. One is we wasted our opportunity. I have to be honest, the person I am today is not the person who I was 5 years ago, and is definitely not the person who I was when we first started. And for those who are kind of more into on the SEO side, in 2018, don't quote me on the dates, it's all very fuzzy, Google released what's called the Google Medic Update. And they targeted YMYL space, your money, your life. So basically finances and health. And on the finances side, they were worried about all the crypto bros, right? Duping a lot of people, which in the last 6 months, a lot of people have lost serious money. And on the health side, they were worried about a lot of these guys selling you garbage, right? Like, hey, buy this tanning bed, it'll cure everything. You know what? Eat this slug. Or like the Liver King, right? Just got exposed, right? Eat liver and suddenly you're the most huge person, when really anyone in the industry knew it was all kind of bunk, but the end user doesn't know any better. So before Google hit, we were getting 50, 60,000 visitors a day. And the day after they implemented this, we fell to 4,000 a day. And of those 4,000, 95% of them were examine searches. So someone was searching on Google for examine creatine, ashwagandha and examine.com. We didn't even know this had happened until people started emailing us being like, hey man, I can't seem to find you on Google anymore. What happened? We wasted all that traffic we were getting over all those years before. Even today, we're now at 25,000, which is much improved from the 4,000, but we're still halfway where we were at our peak. So it was wasted. Like I didn't fully appreciate the potential of what examine could be until maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when I was like, wow, we can actually build a juggernaut that squishes everyone else, because we've got that reputation, we've got that brand, we can build it up. So that was one huge mistake, that the opportunity was there. It's almost like, you know, you wish, or at least I didn't start lifting weights till I was 28. I wish I was lifting weights when I was 14, right? I can't imagine what I would, like, my body would feel better and all that kind of stuff. Like, I wish. So it's one of those, like, regret of wasted time.
Well, on that specific point, so if I can just jump in, because what would you have done differently? You can't control what Google is doing. What would you have done had you seen that coming, you know, in the headlines?
So it was less more of the see it coming in the headlights. It was more how we were fundamentally doing things. We should have done a better job growing our email list more aggressively. So the other side of it that's connected to it is, for far too long, our entire business model was based on selling guides. And being kind of who I am, very, let's say, progressive, I was like, you buy the guide once and you get lifetime updates. So we've had people who bought back in 2013 and they paid us $19, I think was the cheapest ever. And they still have full access to the website. They haven't lifted a finger since then. They haven't had to pay a single cent. We've restricted nothing from what they originally bought. Like, that's actually something we're proud of. But like, $19 over the course of 10 years is not any kind of revenue. So the mistake we made was we were making too many guides. And it really came to a head in 2019, sorry, my numbers are always off, when we released a whey protein guide and a keto guide. And it was disastrous for us. The whey protein guide, nobody cares about whey protein that much in the first place. That was a dumb mistake by us. And the keto guide was, people were not in the ketogenic diet because they're like, let me understand the science about how it helps me with epilepsy or, you know, whatever. They were like, I want to be on ketogenic because I want to be ripped and I want people of the opposite sex to throw themselves at me. I want panties and trunks and whatever, just throwing all the time at me. So when we came out with a keto guide, it made us some money, but it wasn't like, our style isn't to say like, hey man, get ripped and jacked and shredded and lean. Like, our stuff was like, we will tell you about the research around ketogenic diet. So we made a mistake trying to sell guys when the real reason why people came to us was, what does the latest research show? And naturally, because latest research is being constantly updated, it is a natural subscription model, right? And you know, there's a lot of like almost, I call them fake subscriptions, where they don't have to be subscriptions, but they make them subscriptions because it works. Examine, on the other hand, makes sense as a subscription business. It doesn't make sense as a one-time business, as a one-time thing. If I'm reading about fish oil in January and I'm reading it in December, the information has changed. Some human has gone in and consistently updated with the 300 new studies that have been published over the course of the year. That is an ongoing cost. So going back to your issue about traffic, we should have always been a subscription business. And we only fully fixed that last year. Only in August did we drop any one-time guides, and we only have one single subscription. Part of it makes life easy. So if we had gone back to in time with all that information or all that traffic and done subscription, we'd be way more ahead. And I'll give you a real life example. That guy that I mentioned, right, that was as low as $19. So ostensibly we sold it for $49, but really most people were buying at $29. We're like, hey, just buy, like, put in your email address. We'll get your email address. We'll sell it for $29. Boom, done, right? Let's just say, I'm making up numbers here because I don't remember the exact numbers. We're selling 10 a day. So $290 a day sounds like a lot, but really it's not, right? In the grand scheme of things, it's a very, very tiny amount. So we eventually made that a $5 a month subscription. And then we added a $40 a year subscription. And then we added a $100 lifetime purchase, right? So we're like, fine, at $100, fine, let's advertise 20 months of purchase. We'll rather have the money today because we need it today more than we need it tomorrow. We were now selling like 25 of these a day instead of the original 10, even though the price got doubled or really quadrupled. But we made way more. So we made a fundamental mistake that our model was trying to be a guide when it should always have been a subscription.
Did you feel back when you launched in 2011, people, the market would have been as willing to pay for a subscription? Because now, you know, you subscribe to Netflix, to Prime, Disney Plus, you know, Sky Sports, your razors coming through the post. That wasn't there 10, 12 years ago. So do you think you almost had to do the guides first because the subscription model would have been just too soon for most people?
I think we would have done both. Okay. Because the moment literally, we switched to subscription, I think it's 2018. Instantly, within 3 months, we were making more money. Or sorry, within 2 months, we were making more money. And that's with, you know, recurring and all. Actually, what am I talking about? So the way we messed it up a little bit. We originally only did monthly for the first 3 months. Then we added a yearly option. I don't know why we waited. Again, dumb, but we all make mistakes. But immediately from that third month, from the ongoing subscriptions, we're already making more. The thing is, if you, at $5 a month is almost insignificant. I'm 100% sure we have customers, I'm not saying this in a bad way, that like see it every month, like, oh, you know what, I'll check it whenever I want. Because they want that reference. Like, five a month is nothing. Nine becomes a bit more difficult. 19, 29 is a much bigger investment. And we had a subscription that we had released that was way too intense for $29 a month. So the appetite for, and that was in 2014, the appetite for it was there. We should have just always converted that to a subscription, or the first year is a guide to generate immediate revenue and then we move into subscription. But absolutely, even considering how the game has changed, even with Netflix or Disney, we immediately started making more money, and I'm 100% confident we would have made more money. And because it's also like, as a user, you see $5 a month, okay, I can sign up. If you see 29 or 49 one time, you're like, I don't know if I, and also the other thing is subscription. It's easier pitch for her to say, we're updating this every single day. You're getting your money's worth. A guide is, it's not as obvious because they're like, are they lying? We don't have to trust, you know, subscription is a little bit more cleaner. So absolutely. It was a missed, a huge, potential that we missed over there. And I'm not saying this in a regretful way, even though maybe there's like 2% regret. It's more just like you learn from it. And I hope other people think about like, hey, is whatever I'm doing, does it make sense as a subscription? Does it make sense as a one-time product? It really depends on what you're trying to offer.
Obviously, COVID has affected the health and fitness industry in myriad ways for all kinds of businesses. And I'm sure you've suffered with it as well. Could you tell us how, you know, any adjustments you made during COVID? I imagine personal trainers are a significant part of your audience. A lot of them are suddenly out of work. How did you get through it and emerge in a stronger position where you're able to relaunch last year?
Yeah, we so when COVID hit in basically February, March, right, we were actually writing about it in end of February, we were starting to write about it. We lost about 60% of our revenue. So we didn't have a lot of personal trainers that got hit. You know, they got immediately shut down, right? The other thing though was it scared people. Because that moment was terrifying, right? We didn't really know what was going on. We're just like, wow, people are sick. You see Italy, you see New York, you're like, this is not good, right? You saw China like welding people in the house, which is insane. It's really crazy. So people got scared, they canceled their, less people were purchasing, cancels, all that kind of stuff. It was scary and there wasn't much we could do. And what I mean by that is, COVID happened, like New York Times, they contacted us. They're like, hey, is there any supplementation that can help against coronaviruses? And we're like, yeah, not really. Maybe this very specific version of zinc, which is not the same thing as a pill, but it's like a almost like a Strepsil. It's disgusting. It's a very specific version of zinc. I don't know off the top of my head. It might be slightly antiviral replication, but it's not targeted towards coronavirus. We don't really think it's going to do anything, but you know, if it makes you feel a bit better. The thing though was then we couldn't change the business for COVID. Right, we couldn't be like, we're gonna sell you immune therapy or boosting or whatever. It doesn't work. We were already in the process. At the time, we weren't publishing individual study summaries like we do now. So we were already in the process of working on it. At the time, it was supposed to come out in April, but it ended up coming out in July. And so our bet was, we think this is useful. It might have made more money if COVID had not hit us, but we think it'll generate enough revenue for us to be okay. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. Like it did better than I'd anticipated, to be 100% honest. And it provided us with a financial base for us to then relaunch Examine 2 and all that kind of stuff that came out last year. So it was definitely, I remember Kamal, because we were in a really bad financial position because we were doing the guides. And that was just the year before COVID hit. So I remember Kamal and I like sitting down being like, okay, we don't have a lot of money in the bank. As the money goes down, what do we do? And we had just had our best, the best months of the year were in February, actually like the non-sales months were in February before COVID hit. So we're like, yikes, right? We know what we can do. Can we, and again, taking the 2-year, 10-year model, can we hold out until things improve and we get to fix all the things we're trying to do? And thankfully, you know, it was able to happen for us.
How close were you to not making it through?
Overall, I think it was more fear than reality. But we were like, our cash balance was under 100,000, or it was almost 100,000. Like, we didn't have a lot and we were losing money every month, but we weren't losing enough. Like, this is the thing, right? If I have 100K in the bank and I'm losing 5K a month, that sounds very scary, but that's 20 months of runway. I have 20 months to figure out. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got from anyone else is that as long as you're making cash, you have time to figure it out. And provided you are not an idiot, you should be smart enough talking to your customers, seeing how they react, to figure it out. So that's always in the back of my head, is like, hey man, even if we're losing money today, even if we're losing money at this point, if I have 30 months to figure it out and I can't figure it out, I almost feel like I deserve to lose the business, because what's wrong with you, right? Like, you have 30 months, figure it out. So it was scary, but doing the math was a little bit more settling and, you know, a little bit less disturbing that way.
Tell me about the relaunch, because I know from our correspondence before this call, it took a little bit longer than you wanted to get it off the launch pad. Tell us a little bit about the motivations behind the relaunch and maybe some of the challenges you encountered in actually getting it live.
Yeah, that thing was brutal. So for context, we started planning it in Jan 2020 before COVID was a concern. And we released it in August 2022. So it took us 2.5 years to release. The problem was, it was multifaceted. So when we started, because we didn't have a grand vision of what exam could be, we just kind of like kept throwing duct taped pieces to the original duct tape piece, which like I can code fast. I am by no means a great coder, even an adequate coder. I'm a mediocre coder. And so we were just duct taping stuff onto more duct tape stuff. And eventually it all became very, unusable internally. So we had to, and so what happened was, separately, cut them on different lines, we're like, okay, currently, everything is a supplement on Examine. We'd have a category page, it would be a supplement. We would say blueberries, it's a supplement. It's obviously not a supplement, it's a food. We have a page on ketogenic diet, it's a supplement. Obviously, it's not. So we had to rebuild on the content side, we had to rebuild all the taxonomy. So we didn't fully appreciate this, and I'll use this as an example. If I'm trying to classify information for the human body, there's like a million ways for me to do it. The easiest is, I can do it physically. Here's the head, and there's the eyes, nose, and mouth, and all that. There's my shoulders, and we go lower. I can do blood system, lymphatic system, reproductive system, right? Nervous system, and that's more of a layer, right? There's so many different ways to slice it. So we basically have to build our own taxonomy. And taxonomy is effectively the structure and how information relates to each other. So for example, if you are interested in blood pressure, that's connected to cardiovascular, it's also connected to systole and diastole, right? But what do the users care about? Users don't really care about systole or diastole. They care about, I have high blood pressure, what's going to increase it? I have low blood pressure, what's going to increase it? And that's also tricky. If you have blood pressure, I have a low blood pressure, for example. High blood pressure doesn't bother me. You might have high blood pressure and you were concerned about hypertension. Hypertension is another thing. Where does hypertension go? In trying to organize all this information in a database is incredibly difficult. So that took a lot of time, is how do you organize the information? The code, the actual software had also become incredibly, I think gunky is the technical term to use. So we had to recode an entire website. Anyone who's ever done a recode from scratch realizes it's a nightmare. Like everything takes double the amount. Even today, there's still things that are not, that are okay publicly, but internally are not as clean as we would like, right? So we had to recode everything. And if we're recoding everything and we're redoing all the content, we have to redesign everything. Right, so we had to redesign it, and as we're redesigning it, and we spent. So there's a framework called Jobs to be Done, and the idea of Jobs to be Done is, you know, everyone says they want this or they want that, but what do they really want? And minivan, the example I use, is my favorite Jobs to be Done. Right, like it, nobody wants a minivan, but it does the job better than anyone else, so people buy a minivan. So we started. So Jobs to be Done, you basically spend like 45 minutes to an hour. You interview a customer, and you really try to understand what were they looking for, like what was happening in their life, what made them decide to make a switch. As someone who was, out of shape, not healthy, and now healthy, like what was the moment in my life that made me get healthy? And it was actually, this one I can share. We were in Argentina with my ex-wife and one of my best friends. And some guy was like, that's the tallest mountain in South America, right? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to climb it. And they both turned around. And in no mean way, they're like, nah, you can't. And it was just, I was like, damn, like, how? They're kind of right. And I remember we went up a ski lift and like within 5 seconds, I couldn't breathe. I was like, dying. It took me 18 months after that moment to start really losing weight. But it got stuck in my head where I'm like, wait a minute, this is not okay. I need to like lose weight. I need to be better about my health. So you do these interviews, and we found out from our users that it was almost like a split. Most people only wanted quick answers to their questions, right? They were like, hey, I have a migraine. What does that mean? What's causing my migraine? What can help me with my migraine? They don't need the database. They don't need the latest research. They're just like, this is my question. Just answer my question. Just leave me alone, right? I don't need a long blog post. That's, blah, 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 ad, blah, 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 buy this, blah, blah, blah. Oh, don't worry about it. You're like, oh my God, right at the end, right? And then there's obviously the people who are more power users, who want the latest research, who want the database. So then we had to redo everything in our content to be like, how do we add all these frequently asked questions? So we generated over 1,000 FAQs, and our FAQ is not like, hey, it takes us 10 minutes to write this. Like we have to reference everything, everything has to be researched, everything has to be doubling. We have a reviewer check it, we have a copy editor check it. So it was just a lot of work to try to build what we think we like users would find useful. And so at the beginning, I talked about interventions. We can eventually add exercise, right? How does a squat impact your bowel movements? How does it impact your leg strength? How does it impact your ability to jump really high? Like, what does the research say? Even stuff like if you're a basketball fan, what's the difference between a high top shoe and a low top shoe? Right? Is arguably a low top shoe is better for ankle mobility because it forces you to stabilize, but a high top is differently arguably better because it provides the stability so you don't have to worry as much, and it provides like a buffer in case your ankle stability is not strong enough. What does the actual research say, right? So that was why like it took so long. Was it wasn't just one thing. We basically burned, it's like buying a plot of land and then burning the house down and then building a half house and then burning it down again and then rebuilding it like 9 stories high. It just took a lot of time to get it right, I think, yeah.
Well, for now, looking forward, now all that hard work has been done, what does success look like, both for Examine and for you personally? Do you have an idea of where you want the brand to get to and where you want to end up?
Yeah, so all the success that I want is very unmetrics based. It's all almost feels based. So as an example, that woman who recorded the 17 minute video, I think we should get one a week. I think that should be our goal, right? So the goal when that becomes your goal is, what do we do to make people feel that strongly, right? Is it the FAQs, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. The other thing that I want that's like my North Star that I tell our employees is, so I think Google came out in 1999. And by 2001, a lot of people knew about it. By 2004, everybody pretty much knew about it. There's still definitely people who didn't know. So let's say you and I are having a conversation in 2004, and you're like, man, I don't know to find something. And I'm like, oh, Joe, just go to Google. And you're like, what's Google? You'd almost be offended, right? You're like, I don't know if I want to be your friend anymore. How do you not know about Google? Everybody knows about Google. How do you not know about Google? That's what I want for examine in the nutrition, in the health space. Any professional, if they're like, what's this ashwagandha thing? I've never heard of it. And you're like, hey man, go to examine. And I'm like, what the hell is examine? You know, you're like, I don't know if this friendship can survive. You obviously are an uneducated fool. You are, I like, ugh, gross. That is the ubiquity of examine as a resource that's trusted by the very health professionals that are people are reliant on for information. That is my actual goal. I don't care about the revenue. I don't care about the valuation. Like, those are nice, almost secondary as indicators of success. But I'm far more interested in ubiquity and trust for the company overall.
You mentioned valuation there. Health is becoming such a big, important aspect for so many companies. When you've got Tim Cook of Apple saying Apple's greatest contribution to humankind is going to be in the health space. Yeah. Questions coming is, Sol, you must have had a lot of companies circling. You're going to have them circling. How long can you stay independent? Will you always stay independent? What is your exit strategy?
I have no exit strategy. So we get, I would say in any given month, we have 2 to 4 investors or acquirers that reach out. Like just recently, we had someone that was like, yeah, we're a $3.3 billion fund and we love what you're doing. We want to invest in you. We have no investors. We have no external money. Kamal and I own the company 100%. And the reason we own 100% is it makes my life simpler. I'm not here. Like, you know, I mentioned that I'm an immigrant. I'm living the immigrant dream. I live in Toronto. I have a house, which is, you know, obviously a huge concern everywhere in the damn world right now. I have a partner I happen to like a lot. We've been together for over 10 years, so I'm already doing well there. I have a dog that's the world's best dog. I'm sorry. It is what it is. I'm pretty content with what I've got. So if I make extra money, like I don't have a car, I have no, my only expensive, let's say, vice is traveling. But when I travel in itself, once I'm there, like, first of all, the one awesome thing about the internet is I have friends everywhere, so I just stay with friends usually. But even beyond that, like I feel weird when someone is like providing service to me or they're my beck and call. Like, I don't need a suite hotel. You give me a little bed that I can just pass out on. I'm comfortable. I'm fine. So I don't need money in itself because it doesn't really do anything for me. So then the question becomes, why do you wake up every day, right? We can even get more like moral philosophy. Like, what is success? Today's success is considered, generally, when people think of success, they think of someone who has money. And oftentimes when success beyond the money is they have a very good looking, but almost subservient partner, but there's no personality behind the partner. They're just like a good looking person that's like a placeholder for you must be doing things right. So I'm much more interested in is, you know, like, how do we make our life meaningful? Or how do we make it interesting? And having someone invest in my business doesn't make it meaningful, right? Having some, I want $100 million for examine and then I'm out. Like, having that kind of target, I think it's a little bit corrupting because then that becomes your goal, right? Like, we talked about what's the North Star of examine. If I'm trying $100 million, I'm like, right? If I do this, and then maybe we're making $20 million in revenue and that's 5X and I can pitch somebody for this, or if I fire these two employees, my profit is high enough that someone's going to pay me, that kind of stuff. I don't need that in my life. Like, so for example, we do 4-day work week. We've done it for over a year. And the entire genesis of 4-day work week was I read some, you know, little studies here and there, like, oh, we did 4-day work week. It didn't really impact productivity. And I thought about my work day and I'm like, I don't really work much on Fridays. Usually I just do all my meetings on Fridays. But I know once Thursday afternoon hits, I'm like, whoa, like I think I'm done. And so I was like, you know what? I don't want to work on Fridays. Like, I just don't want to. Like, I don't care about the money enough relative to do it. And then I felt weird, like I can't not work on Fridays and everyone else works on Fridays. So I'm like, okay, let's just make everyone 4-day work week. And that was it. Like, that was the entire genesis. And I think everyone, I know, I'm actually pretty confident, most employees love it. Some people feel weird because all their friends are working and their day is off, or their partner's working and they feel kind of weird, especially because everyone, a lot of people are working from home now, or these days. But that's really the driver. So yeah, we get a lot of interest. I never say no, in the sense that, you know, you never want to say never to anything. But I honestly don't see any future. Like I was talking about 22 years for exam, and I don't see any near-time future where I'm like, ooh, yeah, I'm going to cash out. Because once I cash out, what am I going to do with my time? Like, there's nothing that I'm like feeling the hunger to do or build or anything like that. So as an example, I'm going to spend the next month in the Dominican Republic because I'm tired of Canada's cold weather and like overcast. Until like 4 days ago, we had 2 hours of sunlight this entire year, which is ridiculous. And so I can't. But if I had an investor, I can't really do that. And if I sold a company, I could do it, but I can do it anyway today. So sorry, that's my like weird little tangential answer. It's like, I'm enjoying life and Xamarin is interesting. And we actually, I don't want to be rude to anybody, but you know, selling a phone case, you're not really helping people out much. Yeah, I mean, I guess my phone doesn't crack. Thank you. I don't have to buy another phone. But in the grand scheme of things, and again, I'm not saying this in any mean way, we help people, we enjoy our work. So I'm pretty content where I am right now.
I want us to talk about staff and some of the benefits you're offering, because I feel you're unique in some of the schemes that you've got, maybe for Canada or certainly for the wider world. But with moving to the 4-day work week, I assume there's not been any tangible drop off in productivity. Can you talk a little bit about how it's impacted the business?
The only issue with the 4-day work week is the world works at a 7-day work week. And so for the 4-day work week, it's a little bit weird because people are sending us messages and emails and whatever on Friday. And then they're like, why did you respond at times? We're like, dude, like, first of all, relax. Nothing is that important. I don't think the productivity impacted much. I think the average person during the average course of a business day takes a lot of time off, kind of dicks around or gets distracted or, you know, takes a 40-minute bathroom break. So instead, I think most people, there's always scammers. So when we hire, we put people to the ringer, and the ringer is not like Google with 19 interviews. We're more just like, what kind of human being are you, right? Are you an adult? Because we're going to treat you with respect as an adult. We're going to pretend. We're going to imagine you as a responsible adult. And if we tell you to do X, you'll get your X done. I don't care how you get the X done. I don't care if you work from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. or work from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. or work for an hour and go sleep for 2 hours and work for an hour. As long as you're getting your stuff done, I don't care. And so in that context, the 4-day work week hasn't really made much of a difference, because people are just wasting time less, or they put all their, like, let's say, chores and stuff to do on the Friday. You have to go to the doctor. You have to go to the vet. You have to get a teeth clean. You have to do all, you know, there's always like, you have to get your driver's license. Everyone just shoves it to Friday. And because they know they can go at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m., 11 a.m. or 1 p.m. on Friday, they don't have to worry as much. I think it just focuses everyone to get the work done by Thursday, and then everyone buzzes off. And we're very big on like, don't send Slack messages on Friday. I'm actually like, Slack can track the number of messages you send across every day. And I love seeing how it crashes on Friday, stays down on Saturday, Sunday, then boop, Monday spikes right back. And then, you know, there's a little sinusoidal wave across the 4/3-day split right there.
Some of the other benefits that I've seen that Xamarin offer in terms of the 4-month paid paternity leave, 6-month maternity leave, paying staff $500 to take a week's holiday to make sure they do use their holiday, but also the transparency and the data and the business information you share with your staff. Mm-hmm. I mean, where does that desire for complete honesty and transparency come from? Is it because that's how you would want to be treated, or you believe that it just fosters a greater sense of a family, community, camaraderie, you're in it together?
All of those things. So one of the things I super am shocked by is the amount of domain knowledge a person accrues over years is not something you can quantify, right? So if someone has worked for me for 3 years, they know all these, no matter how good you are at recording things in a standard operating procedure, SOP, playbook, whatever the hell you want to call it, there's always these little things you don't know. As an example, this is super bizarre. Google Analytics 4, right? That's you have to use it if you use Google Analytics. You can't use it the old version past July. Their data modeling only stores it for 2 months. And I posted complaining about how complicated it was on social media, and some guy messaged me and he was like, hey, by the way, you might want to switch it from 2 to 14 months. I did it. I didn't write it down anywhere. I told my front-end developer, he might remember it, but nobody else knows. And I didn't write it down because it's like the most minutia of minutia. Like, what is the chance we'll change our Google Analytics? But now, let's say, you know, I leave and the front-end developer leaves and something happens and they change the Google Analytics for a different account. Suddenly, all the numbers are going to go off because they went from 14-month full attribution to just 2 months, right? There's all this little thing. So to me, the worst possible outcome, almost always the worst possible outcome, is having an employee quit because of reasons from you, right? Like the number two, top two reasons people quit is they're not paid enough and they hate their boss. Right. So I think we can take care of the second one. We can work on the first one too in different ways. Now, the transparency thing is a lot of like, yeah, how I'd want to be treated. But the other thing that's super interesting is when you don't provide transparency to your employees, they're just going to make up things. And one of my favorite stats is like, I think it was like 70% of employees think a company's profits are their actual, in reality, their revenue. So when we started sharing our numbers with our team, they were like, oh, I see. We really don't make that much money whatsoever. And our profits really don't even exist at the time, right? And so as an example, when COVID hit, almost every single employee was offered to defer salaries or take pay cuts or whatever, because they were like, hey, I've got savings. I can coast a little bit on them. I know, I trust you guys that you guys are going to take care of us when things get better. And that's what we do, right? We do our own annual, let's say, payroll increases. You don't have to like negotiate with us. You don't have to tell us. We realize how much inflation is. We try to stay on top of all those kind of things. And so really it is, how would I want to be treated? And we know time away from work is critical. Like every genius person in the back in the day, Albert Einstein, I was listening to Thomas Edison. I don't even really like him that much, but we'll throw him in. Charles Darwin, all these guys, they frequently went on breaks. They frequently took walks. They took quiet times because your brain is always kind of churning things, right? You might see a bird and you're like, oh, that's an interesting, oh, the chime is interesting. Maybe we should do this. Maybe we should do that. So to me, it's almost selfish to me where I'm like, yeah, take your time off, take the relax. It's not the end of the world. Nothing we do is the end of the world, right? It's like if we get a page wrong for a day, it's unideal, but no one's going to die from it. No one's going to get injured grievously from it because we have so many steps that generally it's like more nuance and context stuff that we miss. So if I treat my employees right, they'll treat me right. And then the treating you right part is great because I can offload responsibilities, right? If I trust you, let's say Joe is an employee, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to explain to you the why. And the reason I'm going to explain to you the why is if I'm doing something that's incongruent with what we're talking about, what we're trying to do, you can step in and be like, what's going on here, right? If I'm like, hey, we're doing this because of this reasons, you can figure out what the KPIs are. You can figure out what it looks like. You can figure out how you would want it, right? So we're very big on, we try holacracy, like flat. It's a little bit difficult because sometimes you need one person to push things. We did like our own little modified version. Kamal and I exist, and then everyone else is quasi-flat. Everyone is considered a colleague, and then their team leads in the respective area. So no one's your boss, but they're the ones in charge of pushing things forward. So there's consensus building, all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you treat your humans right, they will never leave. And so in the last 5 years, we pretty much had nobody ever leave the company because they know they're going to be treated right. We're going to take care of them. Easy example. We even had our annual retreat in Mexico because we have 3 employees outside of North America, and it's hard for them to get visas to US and Canada, especially during COVID because everything was shut down. And so that was a signal to the entire team that we will put in the time and effort to take care of the entire team, not just the North Americans or this specific or that specific. So, and the other final thing with the transparency thing is an economy is it reduces like politics. Like, I don't remember the last time, maybe, you know, in the course of a year, if I talk to a fellow person who has, let's say, at least 20 employees, there's at least some kind of drama once a week, right? We get it once every 6 months, I would say, because in general, you hire for nice, friendly people, you treat them right. And you go like, yo, if you need to take a sick day, take a sick day. And you make that risk. You take that bet that maybe 1 out of 100 will abuse it, but the other 99 won't. So why would you punish the other 99 because of the behavior of one asshole, right? Like it's insane because everyone else then now is, you know, like that's why you can't have nice things. Like you're punishing all these innocents for the actions of a bad thing. And as the boss, my job is to cut that one person out. So the other 99 are only the ones that are left and none of them cause me headaches. So that was my long short version is it makes my life easy. It makes everything easier for me. So I am bewildered by how rudely bosses treat their employees. And we have so much data that shows tough love works for a small percentage of people, which was the classical boss, right? You yell at them, you scream at them, you give them tough love, Marine style, whatever. But the data clearly shows that for the majority of people, you treat them nice and you kind of encourage them and they will do amazing things for you. So that's why.
Yeah, it certainly feels as though most companies are at the other end of the spectrum compared to you guys and still treating staff like little school kids. You know, you've got to be there at a certain time. You have to finish at a certain time, even if you've done all your work. And it just creates an environment where people will drag tasks out to fill up the time, right? And I think the sooner we can move to a model more like the one you just talked about, you're going to have a happier workforce, you're going to have a healthier workforce. Productivity is probably going to go up and it's going to be a win-win, right? But it's going to take time for bigger companies to get there.
It takes time and it's a little bit weird, I'll be honest, right? Like I am generally not a very very feely person. I tough love works for me, right? Like it is something that works for me. So I'm not one who needs to be encouraged. I'm a kind of guy who'd be like, F you, I want to do what I want. Don't tell me what to do. I would tell my teachers in high school that they're going to work for me. Like that's the kind of like person I was, right? I was very mouthy. I was like, don't tell me what to do. So, and that's what's even funnier, right? It's like, it's the inverse of who I am naturally, where I'm just like, do the work and leave me alone. I don't care, right? Am I going to bother you? But in the long term, it's nice because you get to know your team. You get to know what they, and going back to the original conversation about networking, right? Like I know this one person loves the NBA and this one person loves that. And we can chat about this. And having the bonds makes you, I don't want to say disappointed because it's not like a parental relationship, but it's like this other person is, I feel the responsibility of them trusting me, but they also feel the responsibility of me trusting them. And it's not manipulative. It's friendship almost, right? It's like, yo, you're good at this. If a copy editor says X is better than Y, unless I feel very strongly over Y, I'll be like, yeah, man, you're the person's job. Like, this is your job. I'm not the super, I'm smart, but I'm not that smart. So let's go with what you said. And sorry, I've even found that even when you know an employee is wrong, sometimes letting them learn the mistake, if it's a small thing, is worth it, right? Because then they're like, oh, you know, I didn't think about this, or I didn't realize this, or oh, wow, this is so obvious in hindsight. They will never make that mistake ever again in their life. If you don't let them make that mistake, it's very possible in some worse situation, they don't make that connection. And, you know, it's just worse for everybody that way.
You mentioned earlier on, one of the best bits of advice you'd ever got was if you can make money, you can buy time.
Yeah.
Is there any other kind of advice that you got that has stayed with you throughout the course of your career? Or is there anything that you tell people now you're in a position where asking you for advice? Have you got anything that you kind of always think back on or something you give out?
Joe, I have so many opinions. I think the more central one is that a business in itself exists to solve a problem. And if you don't really understand the problem, you can't really monetize. And connected to that is once you figure out the problem and are able to monetize the problem, you will find a bunch of related problems that are all linked to the same damn thing. I think Apple is a great example. The problem of computers was they were complicated to use. I say this as a computer engineer. I grew up with config.sys and in MS-DOS and autoexec.bat, right? Bash files. I grew up with that. I love that stuff, but I appreciate the complexity. And it was the same thing, right? They brought the simplicity of the iPod to music. They made it easy, right? iTunes Store made it easy. Walled garden, all that stuff. Nobody cares about a walled garden in general. The nerds do, and I appreciate why they care about it, but that was their thing, right? They were solving the problem easy. And as they solved one, they realized there's another one and another one and another one. So I think people see too much of a business as them or as a representation of their ego or something else, when really, you know, the ugliest, boringest companies make a ton of money because they know what the problem is and then they solve it. So that's usually the number one thing I say. The other thing that really kind of grinds my gears is, you know, we always hear the story about this, hard on their luck, working hard person who pulled themselves up by the bootstraps and they made themselves successful. And why can't you, you know? And it's supposed to be aspirational, but in reality, it's almost indicative of your failures. It's like, if they can do it and they had all this against them, how can you not do this? I hate the fact that we don't appreciate survivorship bias. I hate the fact that it's basically, if a person wins the lottery, you're not going to be like, ooh, the lottery is a great idea. And it's an extreme version. But if 900 people fail and that one person was successful, that doesn't make them smart. That just makes them, I don't want to say this meanly, but there's a lot of luck involved with that success. So I wish people were a little bit more cognizant that you every like really what a business is you're making a smart bet. If you had a coin that you knew flipped head 60% of the time and four times in a row it came tails, you would still bet head the next time, provided it's still a 60%, you know, somebody didn't like tamper with it separately. You would still bet head the next time because that is most likely to be the right. And so I think running a business is basically trying to make a million 55% bets. So eventually you'll go up. You might have like a string of 10 failures in a row, 45% kept coming up. You kept failing. But if you make enough smart bets over enough time, and this is where cash flow becomes important because it gives you time, you can be successful. You don't have to go for the home run. You don't have to go for the virality. Solve the problem, make smart bets. And if you do it thoughtfully in a good process, you should end up generally, you know, I don't want to say successful, but you should generally end up where you're trying to hopefully be.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.